Mm-hmm.
Yeah, except you don't have free Martin humans. You do in the calf, though, in the cow. The sex character, we have calves of different sex. The sex characteristics of one sex operate a little before the other, and it affects the embryonic development of the sib. So you wind up with a heifer that won't breed, called a free Martin.
Never heard of. We're learning.
Now with humans, you have fundamentally two types of twins, identical and sib. You don't know what the word sib stands for, don't you? Sibling, which means brother and or sister. It's an invented word. There is no, they didn't used to have an English word for this. Sib twins can be of the same sex or opposite sex. If they're opposite sex, you know they're sibs, because there had to be two independently fertilized ovums. If they're of the same sex, you've got to look them over carefully and decide whether they're identical or sib, because they could be either. Now, if they look alike and talk alike, you've got your typical identical twins, where the zygote made a cleavage, a complete separation, right at the first level of division, and then proceeded with the same inheritance factor. Now, as you study this, ponder the mystery. I had a classmate once who was studying law, and he was one of these fellows that didn't care whether SMU or Notre Dame won. And we got to talking one time, and he said to me, "Sadly, you don't believe in God, do you?" I said, "Yeah." "Oh, heavens," he said, "you with a scientific education." "Well," he said, "you don't believe this Christ nonsense, do you?" I said, "Yeah. Matter of fact, I do." "Oh, heavens, Immaculate Conception and all that sort of unprintables." "Well," I said, "well, let's not split the hairs too fine, but," I said, "I believe in your divinity." "Oh, now, come on, Buster," he says. "Hocus pocus, jiggery pokery. It's an ancient superstition." "Well," I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do, Alan. I'll make you a deal. You tell me how you got here, and I'll tell you how he got here." "Oh, brother." "Well," he says, "it starts out with a seminal discharge." I said, "Fine." And he said, "the sperm starts swimming." I said, "Why?" "Who told them where the ovum is? How do they know where to go? Why don't they swim in the opposite direction?" "Gee," said, "I hadn't thought of it." I said, "Strike one." "Well," he says, one of them wins the steeplechase and fertilizes the ovum." I said, "Why don't a number of them fertilize the ovum? Why don't several dozen or several thousand fertilize the ovum?" "Jesus, I don't know what happens there." I said, "Surface tension goes up on the ovum, and the Johnny-come-latelys bounce. They can't get the snout in." I said, "How does the ovum know to do this? Who told the egg?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Strike two." "Well," and he said, "cellular division starts in." I said, "Why should it? Why shouldn't the ovum be perfectly happy to be a single-celled organism, just like an amoeba?" He said, "I hadn't thought about that." I said, "Strike three, Al, you're out." And I said, "You can't tell me either why cellular division differentiates, specializes, to produce skin tissue, bone tissue, the lens of the eye, hair, teeth, and why early in the game a few of these cells draw to one side and subdivide at a much, much slower rate. This is the germplasm of that new creature with the seeds of immortality in it." Now, I'd like to associate a statement in the papers with what we've just been considering. This is some comments made by a Melchizedek concerning the bestowal of Jesus. Your ranch immortals have varying concepts of the miraculous. But to us, who live as citizens in the local universe, there are few miracles. And of these, by far the most intriguing are the incarnational bestowals of the Paradise Sons. The appearance in and on your world by apparently natural processes of a divine son, we regard as a miracle, which is to say, the operation of universal laws beyond our understanding. Jesus of Nazareth was a miraculous person. To me, human conception is a common miracle. It is a process which operates in accordance with laws far beyond my understanding. I'm sure this is not a miracle to a life carrier. But how Michael got here as Jesus is a miracle to a Melchizedek. There are things in the universe he doesn't understand, but he sees them happen.
Are you supposed to like carry, do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they work with this. I'm pretty sure they know just about how it happened. But I jolly well don't. I look at a human being, I look at any living creature, and I see the end product of superhuman engineering. Now, we build contrivances, and we are increasing our efficiency in our construction, but I know nothing which can touch organic efficiency in compactness, versatility, adjustability, durability, repairability. Nothing that we do in the mechanical end can approach the efficiency of the organic machinery of life.
Well,
yeah.
Jesus, one part of Jesus was a natural human being, just as we are.
Yes.
The mystery, and it seems to me that it would not come from the life series, perhaps but from the mind implantation.
His mind was just like ours. He had seven adjutants working in there.
His infinity is the puzzling part.
Well, here, let me give you my theory, which is obviously wrong. There's something wrong with my theory, but I find it very satisfying to me. So let me present this to you as a probable distortion of truth, but one which gives me great comfort. Each of us has a personality. And I use the word personality now in the specialized sense that's used in these papers. I'm not talking about temperament or character or sex appeal or social grace or anything else. It's not matter, it's not mind, it's not spirit. It is a fourth kind of reality. We get this personality from God. It comes to no one automatically. God bestows personality upon each creature as a free will, conscious choice on his part to give that creature personality. Being God, he's consistent. If he gives it to one human, he gives it to all humans. But each time it's a volitional act on his part. He gives personality to Seraphim. He gives personality to Melchizedek, Lenanandek. He gives personality to Creator Son. He gave the original personality to the Eternal Son. But it's not an automatic act. I find it helpful to view the mystery of the Incarnation in this wise. I think Joseph was just as much the ancestor of Jesus as was Mary. I think Jesus displays inheritance factors from both of his parents, as do all human children. I think he came into this world a little Jewish baby, just like his brothers and sisters and all other babies come into this world. But when it came time to bestow personality upon this baby, God did not bestow a new personality. He bestowed a very old personality upon this baby. You see, people cling to the immaculate conception not because they want hocus pocus, but they want an explanation of the divinity of Christ. In principle, there's nothing wrong with the Immaculate Conception. There was something different. It just didn't happen to be on the biological level. It took place on another level.
I don't see how they think that that would alter in any factor.
Because personality dominates any living system. And this
I
is...
I know people who believe in the Immaculate Conception. I can't see why they think that that would alter a great deal.
They have no alternative.
The secret of what people think is wrong.
Well, they have no other way to justify the belief in his divinity. Actually,
what it means to me is that they make something simple as sex marriage, but it actually not.
That's tied into Paul's teaching, sure.
When
sure.
They bring up the Immaculate.
You've got overtones there. As Paul said, it's better to marry than to burn, but there's darn little difference. Paul was jilted by some female. It's obvious. I think if she'd been a nicer to him, he'd had nicer things to say about the gal.
Oh, Bill, you were saying that he received the personality that he had always had.
This was Michael's personality that came here.
I think that's beautiful.
Now, personality, all by itself, is a non-reality, almost. It's an abstract reality. I'll illustrate. I want you to think of the color red. You can do this, can't you? No trouble. Have you ever seen the color red all by itself? The answer is no. Never. You always see something which is red. Neither will you ever find personality all by itself. You will always meet a being who is a person. But as the color red dominates the hue of whatever it impinges on, so does personality dominate the entire living organization of the being who is that person. Again, to be helpful, as you try to think of personality in action, you can't. Because we never experience personality within ourselves or in our fellow humans, except as it is associated with mind. Neither do we ever see mind, except on the animal level, without personality. Human beings have personal minds. And that's why you have a little trouble figuring out these adjutants in the abstract, unless we look at animals. Because on the human level, you cannot separate the seven adjutants from the presence of personality. All human minds are personal minds. And all human personalities are associated with mind. Burke asked a question. She said, who makes the decision to decide, the mind or the personality? I said, the personal mind makes that decision. You cannot functionally separate them in spirit. You can think of them in abstract, like you can think of the color red. But you have never seen red all by itself, have you? It's a crude illustration, but it's a good one. We never encounter personality as such, only beings who are persons.
We have had for numbers of what they call infant prodigies. What would be your explanation of those?
How do you account for an infant prodigy? I'll give you the paper's explanation, which I think is better than mine.
Where did I find
it? Oh, we'll look for it in a minute.
Okay.
Before a thought adjuster volunteers to indwell a human being, this thought adjuster has before him, we have no pronoun that fits this, I can't say it, and him is wrong too. Before adjusters volunteer to indwell human beings, they have before them working models of this person to be. They collect the seraphic drafts of ancestry. This is done by the reflectivity system. They go back into the gene structure of this being. They get a projection of what opportunities are going to be for real mind function, real spiritual growth, and combined intellectual-spiritual activity. With full foreknowledge of you who are to be, your adjuster volunteers to come down and indwell you. All adjusters are volunteers, and they volunteer with knowledge aforehand of exactly what they're getting into. They picked you. They're not allowed complete freedom of choice in volunteering. Maybe more than one volunteer, in which event their supervisors will select. These adjusters have had previous experience, some of them, in indwelling. If a human being does not choose survival, the adjuster retains the transcript of all that was of value in that human life. Perchance the adjuster indwells a human being who is not to survive by adjuster fusion, by a different type of fusion. The adjuster also brings away all of the transcript of the value of that human life. It's a carbon copy. They don't take anything away from the human. The human has it and the adjuster has it. They make a copy. Let's say that today on Divinicum, in the near regions of paradise, there is a forecast of a baby. I'm going to pick my ages arbitrarily and don't ask me to justify them. This baby is 3 weeks old, or 6 months, or a week. This baby is to be the great musician that they say may someday be born on our world. I'm sure they would not permit an inexperienced adjuster to indwell that child. I'm sure that the authorities on Divinicum would select from perhaps many volunteers that adjuster who would have the greatest experience in working with musical endowed minds. Yes.
Where did the idea come from that this particular child is to be the great musician?
The gene structure, hereditary forecast, the probability. This child may be killed in an accident at age 8 and never
mature
to this promise.
But he has the promise of being a
The possibility is there, yes. I'm sure that when they looked over the seraphic drafts of ancestry of the apostles, that they did not permit an adjuster who had had experience in a great orator to indwell one of the Alpheus twins. I'm sure Peter would have come as an adjuster, don't you think so? You see, now remember now, the adjuster that indwelled the Alpheus twins is just as divine as Peter, is just as loving as Peter, just as competent as Peter. They're all fragments of God. But some adjusters have picked up additional experience, and they're certainly not going to waste that experience. They're going to be practical about this.
But do you think some of these adjusters must have to be pushed into service?
No. No, I'll tell you why. Because it really means what is written, Wilma. God is no respecter of persons.
Yeah, but you admit that their ancestry is studied.
Right. Look, let's say parents have some mixed offspring, and one of them is not well endowed. Going to get into a lot of trouble. Do real parents spurn that offspring? No. They may do more for it.
No, but the idea that they have a choice gives me the idea that there must be some that they do not volunteer for. They must have to say, come on over here, Jim, you're going down there, whether you like it or not.
No, Wilma. No, no. This is man's idea of man. I remember during the war, my two older ones came bounding in one day and said, does God love Adolf Hitler? I said, certainly. And just as much as he loves you.
Well, I understand
but,
that.
But I said, you don't have to love him. That's God's prerogative. And I said, he may be terribly disappointed in his performance.
He must be. He ought to love him.
I can't merchant that, that I said to an 8-year-old. Who's living in the middle of war surrounded by propaganda. I think if we had God's viewpoint, we would love him. We'd see his need.
What about the suggestion that he was
a borderline case. Let's just say a borderline case without defining it. Here's a case where the cards are stacked terribly against this person. Divine love, Wilma, would be challenged for that. The adventure would be greater.
Right now I'm reading the Life of Stanley.
Yeah.
And he had the worst beginning of anything I've read in a long time.
Don't you suppose that adjusters share the adventuresomeness of God? Consider survival as a horse race. Don't you suppose a thought adjuster would get a real thrill out of riding a dark horse to win, place, or show? In crude language. Don't we get a real thrill out of that?
After he's pushed into occupying him.
No. No, but he doesn't have to be pushed in. You see, these entities, Wilma, are fragments of God, and God loves in a way that is a little bit hard for us to understand.
I'm sure it is.
My heart tells me that he has to love this way, though. The greater the challenge, the greater the need. The greater the need, the greater the adventure. The greater the opportunity for service. I can dimly sense this. Let's say I had a chance to serve two different corporations. One that's in fine working order and one that's in trouble. And I only have time to choose one. I'll take the troubled one.
That's because
the challenge is greater.
Now.
No, this is purely intellectual. The challenge is greater. There's more to be done. There's a greater need over there. There's a greater opportunity to serve.
There again, Bill, you have those who welcome challenge and those who do not.
It's just more fun, Wilma.
But everybody's in that way.
I suppose. The thought adjusters are, I think.
You think they are?
Sure they are.
They welcome a challenge.
Then, I'm still on this question. I'm going to stay with it. We usually drift all over, but this is an awful good question. Oh, there's one more thing that operates here now. I think it's in celestial origins. There are three factors in genius.
This is plenty cool.
Cool or not? Todd, you better come up here where it's cool.
Yeah, I'll better come up where it's cool.
Sure.
Wait, just move. Yes, here's my last factor. On page 507, although celestial artisans do not personally work on material planets such as Urantia, they do come from time to time from the headquarters of the system to proffer help to the naturally gifted individuals of the mortal races. When thus assigned, these artisans temporarily work under the supervision of the planetary angels of progress. The seraphic hosts cooperate with these artisans in attempting to assist those mortal artists who possess inherent endowments and who also possess adjusters of special and previous experience. There are three possible sources of special human ability. At the bottom, always, there exists the natural or inherent aptitude. Special ability is never an arbitrary gift of the gods. There is always an ancestral foundation for every outstanding talent. In addition to this natural ability, or rather supplemental thereto, there may be contributed the leadings of the thought adjuster in those individuals whose indwelling adjusters may have had actual and bona fide experiences along such lines on other worlds and in other mortal creatures. In those cases where both the human mind and the indwelling adjuster are unusually skillful, the spirit artisans may be delegated to act as harmonizers of these talents and otherwise to assist and inspire these mortals to seek forever perfecting ideals and to attempt their enhanced portrayal for the edification of the realm. Here's the answer to your question, I believe. There are three things in there. What you are, what the genes gave you to begin with, what the adjuster may contribute, and then some coaching.
And the remainder of that sheet of paper then is a wonderful promise.
Yes, it is. It just says in there, no matter what you want to do, if you really want to do it, you'll have a chance to do it.
Bill, do you think you have Promethean and Epimethean thought adjusters?
No, I just think you have Methean thought adjusters.
Epimethean.
Neither one. You have Epimethean and Promethean management down there. The religious guardians are Epimethean. The angels of progress are Promethean.
Well, they love a challenge.
Sure.
Bill, is a thought adjuster an entity before the soul on the mortal?
Yeah. There's a question raised in the papers which is not answered. They say they do not know whether God continues to fragment adjusters or whether adjusters are just plain infinite in numbers. These are fragments dwelling on divinity. No, I think adjusters volunteer. I think, Wilma, if we would know how this is done, if it could be put in language comprehensible to us, I have a feeling we would just sit back and chuckle and say, well, how appropriate. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, well, of course, this is so fair.
Well, the remainder of this paper that she just read, the next paragraph starts out, there is no place in the ranks of spirit.
Yeah. if you want to, if you really want to do something, you're going to have a chance. You'll have a chance. And they tell us that there is nothing of an intellectual, social, or artistic nature that will really separate us when we graduate from the Marantia life. But we'll encounter some spiritual differential. And that will be equalized by the time we enter the core of the finality. And then we'll encounter an absolute differential. And that's going to take a long time to equalize. I think by the time the Alpheus twins graduate from Salvington, they're going to be just as smart as anyone else graduating from Salvington.
I don't think they're Salvington.
Ma'am?
I don't believe they survived the sound of
no.
100 years.
No, I don't think so either. There's too much to do.
Between you and there.
Yeah. Too much to do. Too many places to go see. I still say, if you could have the health and the means, how much time would you like to spend just exploring this planet? You have the health and the means. We'd all want to stay here quite a while, wouldn't we? I like to poke my nose into every nook and cranny. I like to go see little countries like Liechtenstein and San Marino. You know, odd little places. Yeah, I could buy 1,000.
There are millions of islands on this planet.
Yes. Wonderful romantic names like Kerguelen.
I know that one.
Point
that down around Australia.
No, the Indian Ocean where no island should be. How long do you want to spend on the mansion world? They're all different. You got a whole cluster to visit in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem itself. 700 worlds in the constellation system. A billion worlds in Havana. Clyde, you had something you wanted to bring up.
Bill, would you explain your concept of all future potentials on this planet being known and accounted for and taken care of in the original implantation?
How could
what
all...
What is the scheme of this red thing?
How could they pack the full potential for all human growth in the three life implantations? They didn't. But the fact they packed the full potential for the development of evolutionary man. There have been two other sources of gene patterns. The Caligastia staff and Adam and Eve. With those two corrections now, I don't know. I don't know. This is a technical accomplishment. To put, well, when you stop and think of it, let's take a seed of a tree or whatever you get a tree from. How do you pack the tree in that seed? It's there. How do you pack a people in a zygote? You've got a one-celled organism and the whole darn human being is there in potential. It just takes some embryonic growth and birth and some care, deity changing and all that bit, and then you've got a people. An engineer maybe. Or a politician or even a Democrat. Probably something happened in the early embryonic development. To those of you who don't know me, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm the last living Whig. I look at both these parties very objectively.
That's right.
You see, my party hasn't made a major political blunder in over a century. And neither of the other parties can make this claim.
Do you vote, Bill?
I haven't found a candidate. But someday I'm going to meet another Whig and we'll refound this party. But I still stand foursquare on the principles of Clay and Webster. I don't know, Clyde. But when you contemplate you realize that they've taken seeds, wheat, from Egyptian tombs and planted them. And some of those wheat seeds are still alive. Not all of them. They've grown wheat from wheat that was harvested thousands of years ago.
It's still wheat.
It's still wheat, yeah.
It isn't a redwood tree.
It's not a redwood tree, no. I can only reason by analogy and say that as a human is contained in the zygote, as a tree is contained in the seed, so planetary life was contained in the original tree and plantation.
Oh, okay.
Well,
it is.
I
in other words, it is another one of our men.
Yeah. Why don't you turn it off,
Bert?
Will you
have?
Yeah,
right now.
Unless you have them at some time done this and I wasn't around.
Wilma would like.
Wilma
would like to discuss paradise, particularly page 7, paragraph 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Page 7, paragraph 8.
The forward.
Yes, this is a good, this is good to discuss. How do we use the word paradise? Paradise is a term inclusive of the personal and the non-personal focal absolutes of all phases of universe reality. All the absolutes focalize on paradise. That's where you find the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Now this is comprehensible. But on Nether Paradise, in one of those zones, this is believed to be the fulcral zone of the unqualified absolute. Fulcral. That place from which he operates and which he uses as a fulcrum to operate, from which he applies leverage. It applies leverage, pardon. Paradise itself is one of the absolutes. And the simplest description I can give you that carries meaning to me is this. Paradise is the absolute machine which God built for many of the same reasons that men build a machine, to perform something repetitive and mechanical, to govern the physical universe. I think the universal absolute probably operates from some place on paradise. Perhaps both Nether and Upper Paradise. You see, this is the central point of the personal and non-personal absolutes. Well, there are just three absolutes that are personal: Father, Son, and Spirit. There are two more that fall within the scope of divinity, of deity: the deity absolute and the universal absolute. There are two that are neither personal nor deity: the Isle itself and the unqualified epsilon. But this is their center. In a sense, they're saying infinity has no outside, but infinity does have a center. I can accept that, can't you? It has no outer boundary, but it does start from some place, and paradise is its starting place. Let's go on. Paradise, properly qualified, may connote any and all forms of reality. Now, what are the forms of reality? Deity reality, divinity, personality, energy. And this energy may be of a spiritual, mind, or material nature. They speak of paradise spirit. They speak of manota. Well, both are forms of energy, in the larger use of the word energy. Paradise spirit is absolute spirit energy. Manota is the absolute non-spiritual energy of paradise itself. and they are completely indistinguishable. They're too close to God. That close to God, matter and spirit haven't deviated far enough to be measurable. I've used this crude illustration. You have an ammeter voltmeter, and you plug it into paradise and take a reading. You can plug the same device into the eternal sun, and you will it'll give you readings. The same instrument for measuring energy would measure these two energies. They're indistinguishable. They just have two different names. And the name merely recognizes their source, not their nature. In nature, they are the same. You can speak of paradise reality. That would be probably this reality associated with the eternal isle. You can speak of paradise deity. Well, we would think of the Father, Son, and Spirit, or the Trinity, which is also deity reality. We would speak of paradise divinity. That could be associated with the thought of Chester. Mike Hill exhibits aspects of paradise divinity. So does his creative consort. We could speak of paradise personality. I don't know that that phrase is used in the papers, but that could refer to, well, let's say one of the paradise citizens, one of the beings who are native to paradise. We can speak of paradise energy, that's Minota, or any energy emanating from paradise. It could refer to paradise, to mind of origin on paradise, either absolute or sub-absolute. All of these realities share paradise as the place of origin, function, and destiny. They start there, they function from there, they return there. And they share paradise, in this sense, as regards values, meanings, and factual existence. The whole Gishmir, right across the board. They're giving you the designation of paradise as an adjective. Right. Now, the next paragraph gives you the definition of paradise as a noun, not an adjective. Paradise, not otherwise qualified, paradise as a noun, is the absolute of the material gravity control of the first source and center. God does not personally control the physical universes. Why should he? He constructed a machine to do this for him. God is a good delegator. Certainly he could, but he does it because he can contrive a piece of machinery to do this. Why should he occupy himself with something which can be acceptably performed? And when I say acceptably in God's terms, this means with absolute perfection, that can be acceptably done by something else. Paradise is motionless. The stuff of paradise is motionless. The stuff of which paradise is made is called absolutum. And it's a stationary energy system. What's that made of? Cellulose, right? What's cellulose made of? Carbon, hydrogen, and varying proportions and some other things. Cellulose made of? Carbon, hydrogen, and varying proportions and some other things. What are carbon and hydrogen made of? The atoms. What does an atom look like? Very much like the solar system. It's mostly empty space. It's got a nucleus. The electrons spin around. There's all kinds of motion in that corrugated box board there, isn't it? Or in this piece of ceramics here. Everything is in motion. As you view it from the atomic standpoint. We're spinning, aren't we, on the planet. And we revolve around the sun, which is in motion. Around the whole center of the Andromeda Nebula. Our local universe is in motion. The super universe is in motion. Everything has got St. Vitus dance out here in time and space. Everything in Havana is in motion. The Paradise satellites are in motion. Only Paradise does not move. And not only that, the stuff that Paradise is made of does not move. These are living, stationary energy systems. Paradise is unique. It moves not. If you don't think solids don't move, you take two bricks, one of gold and one of lead, and plane them off real smooth. Put them together. Let them sit for a while. And then take them apart a year later and examine them microscopically. And you will find that gold has wandered into the lead and lead has wandered into the gold. To the point where you can find this with a microscope. Now you need to have a very smooth surface there. Yeah, near complete. Like you have in Johansson blocks. You folks know what about Johansson blocks?
You mean a General Motors?
No, these are master gauges.
Well, that's you know what I mean.
Have you ever seen one? They're darn expensive. They're gauges that you gauge other things against. And they come in different sizes. They're kept under temperature and humidity control. And you take two Johansson blocks. They're metallic blocks, like ABC blocks that kids play with. And you take two and you put them together and then ring them slightly. And you can hold the upper one. And the lower one will adhere to the upper one by molecular attraction. They won't fall apart. That's how very smooth they are. You have made a semi-join of metal, the reverse of cutting metal.
You want to hold a minute?
Yeah. An awful lot of mean effect in these paragraphs. Continuing with our discussion of Paradise. Paradise is motionless, being the only stationary thing in the universe of universes. The Isle of Paradise has a universe location, but no position in space. Now, here's what that means. There are three kinds of reality that occupy volume besides, well, wait a minute, I'm in trouble. Accepting mass as we understand it, there are three kinds of reality that occupy volume, that take up room. There's the Isle of Paradise, there's space, and there's not space, mid-space. There's two kinds of space, and we'll forget one kind. I want to talk about the space in which we live. The kind of space in which we live is a reality. We think of space purely in the negative sense. There's no matter there, hence space. But actually, space is a positive reality, not just a condition indicating the absence of mass, matter. We conventionally state a law in physics. gravity diminishes as the square of the distance of the space traversed. You remember that old one? It gets feebler the farther it goes out. This statement completely muffles, obscures, and hides the action of space. It's all hidden, that word distance. Let me restate this law. The statement will be just as accurate, but it will emphasize the positive reality of space. This is a jarring concept in the papers. It's hard to get used to. I found it extremely difficult for many years. Here's my restatement. Space is a positive reality which so acts on the force of gravity as to cause it to diminish as the square of the distance traversed. Now you've got space doing something instead of just being something and being passive. This space is not infinite. This space exists as a sub-infinite volume contained in something which is larger. And the something which is larger is called mid-space. I casually think of it as not space. It also occupies volume. It takes up room. How does mid-space differ from space? Simple. Space is a quality of reality which is favorable to motion. Space encourages things to move. Certain places in space clockwise, other places counterclockwise. It's a characteristic of space. Mid-space, not space, is resistive to motion. It favors quiet. If you were to go, our wonton is described as an oval-shaped lens-like aggregation of stars. And it's thinnest in the up-down direction. Think of a watch that's pulled out of shape a little bit, a little thicker in the middle. An old-fashioned watch. If you were to start directly up through the thin plane of our wonton in the direction of upper our wonton, you would eventually come to a region where there were fewer stars. And as you went on, let's have a spaceship make this physical voyage. As you went on, there would be still fewer stars. You would finally get so far above our wonton that you would actually be able to look down and see the whole of our wonton, to see this lens-like ovoid, which would look like a distant Milky Way. It would have a kind of a unity, as certain areas in the Milky Way have. It looks like clouds up there, you know. We'd see our wonton as a great cloud. I think as we kept on going up, we would discover we were slowing down. We would have some method of measuring our distance from this lens of our wonton. So we would advance the power, and our speed would pick up. But as we proceeded, again we'd slow down. And we would advance the throttle a notch and our speed would pick up. Sooner or later we'd run out of notches on our throttle, wouldn't we? And the farther we penetrated, the slower we'd go until finally the resistance to motion would equal our forward force of propulsion and we'd be stationary. We're making no progress. So we'd come back in 10 years with more power, more jets. and we'd go a little farther, but no matter how much power we brought, we'd stall eventually in our penetration of midspace. We'd encounter a resistance to motion which would equal the force which we could bring to bear of forward propulsion. This is my crude picture of midspace. Paradise is in midspace. Space stops before it reaches paradise. That is what this sentence means to me. The Isle of Paradise has a universe location but no position in space, for the simple reason it's not in space. It's in midspace. It has a universe location because everyone knows where to go to get there. But before you reach paradise, you leave space.
How do they land on the periphery?
I'm sure they have devices. I'll tell you something, though. I think you do that on instruments. There's no landings on paradise except by instruments. Now, I think the transport, Seraphim, Supernathim, Sakonathim, can fly by sight. But paradise landings are all instrument landings, I'm sure.
You mean when they hit the mid-space zone, something takes over?
Something takes over from peripheral paradise and pulls them through. The eternal isle is the actual source of the physical universes, past, present, and future. Well, we can talk a little while on what that sentence means now. Let's go back to before the beginning of all things. I want you to think back in time. We took a voyage in space. Can we travel in a time machine now? I want to make a voyage in a time machine. I want to go back in time. I want to set this machine to go back at the rate of a trillion years a minute. That's pretty fast. In 1 minute, we're going to be back to where our nebula is just starting.
Is that too fast for you folks?
It's pretty fast for me.
I can close this machine down if you want me to. Yeah. The Andromeda Nebula is about 1 minute old on this scale. We'll pick up a little speed, so it won't be quite that fast. And in the first 5 minutes as we accelerate to this speed, we're back to where there's no Andromeda, there's no Nebulon. Now, as we proceed backwards, the suns in outer space are going to thin out and just go out. We're older than they are now. We're before their time. As we proceed at this fearful rate through time, we're going to see the Milky Way grow discernibly thinner. Black patches are going to open up. We're going back of the origin of these suns. Are you with me? As nearly as I have computed, and I've done more than guess at this, I've taken what slim evidence there is in the papers, and I've done some computing. Within an hour of our takeoff, at the rate of a trillion years a minute, we are going to be back of the origin of the super universes. I do not believe they're as old as 60 trillion years. Is that right in our calculation?
We figured them at 30.
30, yeah.
30 trillion.
No, wait a minute. 30,000 trillion.
30,000.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, we got to go back for 30,000. We have to go back for 30,000 hours. So 30,000 minutes. How long is that?
30,000 minutes?
Yeah. Who's good?
Get ready.
Doc, you do the division. At 30,000, I thought an hour was too quick.
Yeah. It's about 5,000 hours.
Yeah.
5,000 hours.
5,000.
Yeah, you keep saying back. You mean
back.
500 hours.
And in. We'll go in as well as back.
No, it's 5,000.
5,000 hours.
5,000 hours. And, let's see. At the rate of 20 hours in a day, divide that by 4, by...
25 would be.
25. Take a fourth of it.
200
days. 200 days.
20. We're dividing by 25.
Yeah.
200.
All right. We're going to travel for the better part of a year at the rate of a trillion years a minute. And in about 8 months, we're going to have cleaned out the super universes. We are back before the origin of the super universes. But now, no matter how long we stay in this time machine, we're never going to get back to the Vona, because it has no origin. We can, in 8 months, we can clean out outer space, we can clean out the seven super universes. But in 8 months, 8 years, 8,000 years, 8 million years, Havona is always there. It's eternal. You get a feeling for its eternity? Now, if we could get an eternity machine instead of a time machine, but we can't. The rest of our voyage we cannot do physically. We'll have to do it mentally. We'll have to do it in imagination. We're going to have to go back of reality in concept. And this is permissible. You can have concepts that are not real, but are still useful. Example, will somebody please show me zero? And I don't mean the symbol. You can show me one of anything, can't you? Or two? Can you show me zero of anything? No. And that's why it took man's mind so long to dream up zero. But can you imagine an arithmetic system without zero? This is a valid concept, isn't it? Even though it's not a factual reality. Are you with me? All right. We are going to depart from factual reality now. But our concepts are still valid. We are going to pull a magical lever on our machine, and we're going to go back in eternity to before the times of Havona. You can only do this in concept. This is not real, but it's valid thinking. We're going to go back before the origin of Havona and before the origin of the infinite spirit, and before the origin of the Paradise Trinity. And the papers do this. They speak of the coming into existence of the infinite spirit. And at the same time warn us, there was no such time. The infinite spirit is eternal. If we can do this, we can eventually go back to where there is nothing but paradise. And on paradise, you have only the Father and the Son. The third person has yet to appear. And the central universe has yet to appear, because they came into existence simultaneously. Came into existence. It's a figure of speech. They never came into existence. They're eternal. Now we're back to the point where we can explain the sentence. And what does the sentence say? The eternal isle is the actual source of the physical universes, past, present, and future. What did paradise do? Paradise disgorged something of an unlimited nature, out of which every single material thing that was ever going to be in all future eternity could be derived. the nebulae, all the suns, all the dark islands of space, all the planets, the planetismals, the comets, the whatnot, could be derived from this. And it's infinite. There's no limit to it. When paradise disgorged this future universes of all eternity, what happened? I think of paradise as pitching it out into space. And guess who caught it? The unqualified absolute. And ever since then, the unqualified absolute has been the custodian, the controller, and the revealer of that which has paradise as its source and origin. This is space potency. And what the force organizers do with the assistance of the conjoint actor is every now and then they pry a little of this loose from the unqualified absolute and they start a nebula.
Do they pry or do they take it?
They
where it exists. In outer space, not outer space, but in space.
First of all, Wilma, I think the infinite spirit segregates it and makes it responsive to their presence.
Are you cold?
Right.
You answered this, a question that I've had in my mind to ask you yesterday. That was little telepathy that I had all
over you. I think the third source and center, who works on the material level, just as well as on the spiritual level, so operates on a chunk of this potential as to make it responsive to the force organizers. Because when they first go out to do this job, they don't do anything. They just show up and it happens, proving that some agency has ripened this to respond to their presence. From then on, they go to work. And out of this, you get a nebula, as in the story of Andromeda. This thing we're talking about here is space potency. It is a non-discernible presence in space. And let me give you, again, some very crude symbolism. You go outside, it's a clear day. You can take a humidity reading, and you can tell that this air is all full of water vapor. But as far as your eyes are concerned, it looks like nothing. Blue sky, bright sunshine. There's nothing up there. Sure, I know there's air. But as man speaks conventionally, there's nothing. Nothing but blue sky. A cold wave begins to slide over about a mile and a half up. And out of nothing, what do you suddenly find? Clouds are forming from seeming nothingness. And these clouds, from little tenuous wisps, become thunderheads, formidable looking things. And all of a sudden, stuff begins falling to the ground. And it happens to be wintertime, and it freezes solid. We have mass that we can pick up. And this, to me, symbolizes the origin of mass in space. From seeming nothingness, we come to something very solid and concrete. Hailstones, if you please. Yeah. Now, the water vapor is as imperceptible to our senses, if the humidity isn't too high, as space potency is to measurements of most astronomy. Do you get a feeling for this now? Now, the only difference is they start a whirl up there. They start a space tornado. That's what this next sentence means. The nuclear isle of light is a deity derivative, but it is hardly deity. When the Universal Father forever revealed himself in the absolute spirit person of the Eternal Son, he equally expressed himself in the absolute non-spiritual reality of the Isle of Paradise. This is the repercussion to the Son. God is deity, but paradise is not. And if you think you understand the first source and center, contemplate those two revelations of his inscrutable nature. We know the Father of love. We know not the Lord of universes. When I think that love and gravity are two manifestations of God, this is an inscrutable being. The love part I can feel. The gravity part I've got to do some philosophizing about, and yet they must come from the same being.
Do you have any explanation as to why the Isle of Paradise was a repercussion at the time of the coming into being of the Eternal
Son? No, except it's what he did.
I just wanted to...
Yeah. Except it's it seems to be the principle of thesis and antithesis. I don't find this in the book, but as I apply that principle, it seems to explain so many things that are in the book. The spiritual thesis, the non-spiritual antithesis. The perfect central universe, the imperfect super universe. The absolutes of potentiality, the absolutes of actuality. It seems to be a principle which runs like a thread through much of this book. I understand the book a little better as I use that principle as a thinking tool. The nuclear Isle of Life is a deity derivative, derived from deity, but the isle itself is hardly deity. Neither are the material creations a part of deity. They are a consequence. Sure, the suns and stars of space are not deity. They're the result of deity action. Paradise is not a creator. It is a unique controller of many universe activities. Far more of a controller than a reactor. Obviously, it's not a creator. Paradise is a machine. Only beings create or procreate. Paradise is a exercise of control, and in some respects reacts, but more it's a controller. The gravity grasp of paradise is circular, not linear. It does not diminish as of the square of the distance. The grasp of paradise on the fundamental mass of matter, the automaton, is just as strong at any distance from paradise. Throughout the material universe, paradise influences the reactions and conduct of all beings having to do with force, energy, and power. They've got to reckon with paradise. This is the center. This is the center of... This is the center whence comes energy. Currently. Whence came the potential for mass. And the continuing center of the absolute leash of gravity control. But paradise itself is unique. There's nothing else like it. Exclusive, nothing is related to it. and isolated in the universes. Paradise represents nothing, and nothing represents paradise. A creator son is the representative of the universal father and the eternal son. But there is no being that represents paradise. It's just there. Paradise represents nothing, and nothing represents paradise. It is neither a force nor a presence. It is just paradise. It's alone. This, to me, introduces something which is not. Too clearly stated in this book. It's implied. It's implied in many, many places. Many times in this book, it speaks of power personality unification as the technique for the emergence of experiential deity. Many times it says, or paraphrases the statement, in time and space, energy matter is dominant, save in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the control. We'll have to break that one down. Energy matter was here first. It ran pretty much under its own steam. The only thing that can organize cosmos out of chaos is mind. But spirit is striving for the control. But spirit can't influence energy in any way, shape, or form, material energy. Only mind can perform this act. And only a personal mind that can dominate energy, only a personal mind could choose to be spirit-led. And only in this circumstance could spirit be victorious over energy matter. Shall I say that again, or did you get it? All right. Spirit is striving for the dominance in time and space. To be dominant, spirit must become nuclear and central to everything. How is spirit going to dominate matter when spirit doesn't touch matter at any point? The tools of the spirit do not reach the material level. They stop short of it. Mind can dominate matter, and does. Even we dominate our environment. What is the temperature outside today? 100?
About 106, I think.
But we're not 106 in here. This is the fruits of man's mind. Simple illustration. Now, mind can dominate matter, and spirit's trying to dominate the whole business. Under what circumstances can spirit dominate the mind, which in turn can dominate matter? Ah, if that mind is a mind of a personality, because the personality can choose to subordinate his mind to spirit leading. And in so doing, spirit becomes dominant over all things. Let's consider the alternatives. I got a very simple illustration. You ranch it today. Consider the fruits of our scientific endeavors. We've done many things, haven't we? We enjoy many comforts. We've whipped a good deal of time and space problems. I don't have to walk home to Chicago. Rest assured, if I had to walk down here or ride down here on a horse, I wouldn't get down here as often as I do. I don't even have to take a railroad train. against Lyle. We've made this a much more pleasant continent in which to live. We are slowly remaking this continent in our own image. What's a pipeline but an artery? What's a telegraph line or a telephone line but a nerve? Now, human mind, for the last 300 years since the Renaissance, has become increasingly victorious over matter. But human mind, in the mass, has not elected to subordinate itself to spirit guidance. And the net result of all of our unprecedented scientific achievement is this. In my generation, we have scientifically killed more human beings than have ever been killed before in human warfare. And today, we know fear for the first time in American history. And the Russians are afraid of us, too. But if we had elected to subordinate mind to spirit, if we had demonstrated the milk of human kindness manyfold over, if the Russians had done the same thing, we would not fear each other, would we? It's the only way you can make progress, is what's described in these papers. Or to paraphrase it, only the meek could hope to keep the inheritance of the earth. See, we forget the fact that Jesus never said that the meek could not also be strong. Only the strong could presume to claim the inheritance of the earth. And only the meek could ever keep it. Or contemplate Assyria, France, Prussia. Each in turn has fought for domination. Each in turn has been dragged down by a coalition. That's a great statement. The isolation of paradise is a problem which God did not solve. Look, when he set up the absolutes, he unified them, didn't he? There's only one absolute. And yet there are three, but they're completely unified. But when he set up the sun and the Isle of Paradise, he did not unify them. He left it as an unsolved problem to be solved by all the experiential beings, divinities, and deities who were to follow for all future eternity. That's what this statement means to me. And if God had solved that problem, there would be nothing left to do. Does this help you, woman?
Yes, I do. Great deal.
1, 2, 3, 4. Now we're talking about the exact opposite of paradise. We're dealing here with personality in the largest extension of that word, which would embrace the pre-personal and the super-personal, or the adjuster, pre-personal, creatures, personal, transcendentalers, super-persons. All sub-infinite orders and phases of personality are associative attainables. They can associate with each other. This is an attainable goal. And are potentially co-creational. They can collaborate in a creative way. with each other. Any illustrations? Yeah, trinitization. It's an act of creation. When two, the evolution of the soul is an act of creation. The collaboration of a personality and a pre-personal entity. Human personality has some creative attributes. If you don't think so, where do we get music from? New writing. The adjuster has some creative attributes. The union of these two creative realities produces the soul by evolutionary techniques. But that soul just doesn't grow automatically like the embryo does. That's a creative act on the part of the personality and the adjuster. The personality decisions of personal mind produce the fulcrum on which the adjuster can apply leverage to pry into potential and produce actuality. Where does your soul come from? Listen, from nothing you get nothing. It has to come from something, doesn't it? Where does the soul come from? Where is the flax that is spun? Whence comes the flax which provides the stuff for the thread that can be woven into the fabric of the soul? It has to come from somewhere. It comes from unexpressed potentials. Let's go back to the story of the nebula and the water vapor. The potential hailstone was in the air all the time, but just was in a different form, correct? When a creative spirit produces seraphim, how many she produced at one time? 144,000 or something like that? It's a large number of seraphim. Come with me in imagination to Salvington. We're going to witness the creation of a mess of seraphim. I don't know whether you would say a pride of seraphim or a gaggle of seraphim, a clutch of seraphim. Let's see what they call it. Pride of seraphim, as in a pride of lions. Those words fascinate me. All the different words we have. $41,472 at a time. So we're going to be up in the visitor's gallery of this tremendous hall, and all of us have potential. And out of this potential, she fabricated, she transformed this potential into the actuality of 40,000 seraphim. The adjuster and the personality reach into similar potentials for the raw material out of which to fabricate, slowly fabricate, the soul. When this job is done slowly, it's called evolution. When it's done very quickly, it's called creation. Otherwise, there's no difference. Evolution is simply creativity slowed down in time to the place where a creature can participate in the transaction. A creature cannot participate in creativity. It's instantaneous. It's beyond us. We accept it.